Welcome to the Original Jurisdiction Podcast. I'm your host, David Latt, author of a Substack newsletter about law and the legal profession, also named Original Jurisdiction, which you can read and subscribe to at davidlatt.substack.com. You're listening to the 43rd episode of this podcast, recorded on Friday, April 12th. Thanks to this podcast's sponsor, NextFirm. NextFirm helps big law attorneys become founding partners. To learn more about how NextFirm can help you launch your firm, call 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com. Want to know who the guest will be for the next Original Jurisdiction podcast? Follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for a preview. Earlier this month, I paid a visit to UVA Law School to give a talk. While I was there, I also attended a talk, a presentation about textualism by Justice Jay Mitchell, author of the Alabama Supreme Court's controversial IVF-related ruling. As I expected, Justice Mitchell's event was protested. But as I wrote in my newsletter, the UVA protesters were the most polite protesters I've ever seen, and the event wasn't disrupted in the least. Also this month, I wrote about the 2024 U.S. News Law School rankings, in which UVA Law reached what I believe to be an all-time high ranking of number 4. Things have been going very well at the law school on many fronts, not just free speech, but fundraising and faculty hiring, and much of the credit belongs to Dean Risa Golubov. In 2016, Golubov became the 12th dean of UVA Law, the first woman to serve in the role. She's a leading legal historian whose teaching and research focus on American constitutional and civil rights law. We share two alma maters in common, Harvard College and Yale Law School, and she also holds a PhD in history from Princeton. And we share something else in common, too. We're both podcasters. Check out Dean Golubov's Common Law if you don't already subscribe. The current season, titled Free Exchange, is perfect for Original Jurisdiction listeners. Recent episodes have covered ethics at the Supreme Court and how to strengthen democracy and work across differences. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dean Risa Golubov. Dean Golubov, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, David. I'm so happy to be here. This is a pleasure.
So we'll start at the beginning, as I always do. Let's talk about your childhood. I understand you grew up around here, by which I mean the New York tri-state area.
Yep. I grew up partly on Long Island and partly in Brooklyn.
And did you have any lawyers in the family? I believe your parents were not lawyers.
My parents were not lawyers, and there were no lawyers in my immediate family, but my sister-in-law is a lawyer, and she's married to my older brother. And so she's been in my life since I was 11 or 12 and started law school when I was about 14. So I've known her, but not like parents or aunts and uncles or anything like that.
So did she influence your decision to go to law school, since you know that she was going into law school when you were still a teenager before you went to college?
She certainly created the opportunity, the path, right? She showed that it was there. I was always a talkative kid, as many aspiring law students are. And I did debate in high school. And, you know, my family, we talked a lot about social issues. We talked a lot about politics. I was always very active and engaged. So here's the thing. I can't remember the moment when I thought I'm going to law school. It was just always there, you know, and I'm sure that's true for a lot of people as well.
So what did lead you to go to law school?
It's a little cliched, right? I was always doing a lot of public service in college, and I just wanted to make change in the world. I wanted to make the world a better place. That was what I was after.
So I believe we overlapped at Yale Law for maybe a year or two, but didn't meet back then. And that was partly, I believe, because you were getting your PhD in history from Princeton around the same time. So if you were getting a PhD as well as a law degree, were you already thinking about academia or even legal academia specifically?
So I wasn't thinking about legal academia specifically, not having any other lawyers in my family. I really didn't know anything about it. But when I was thinking about graduate school and professional school and college, I had spent my college years doing a lot of public service extracurriculars, but loving the academics. I loved the end of the semester, writing papers. It brought me a lot of joy. And I was frustrated with the idea that now I had to choose one or the other. And I decided I was going to apply to both. I was going to do both. I didn't really know where they would lead. I think if I had a plan or an inchoate plan, it was to do public interest law and kind of find a way to incorporate history. So I worked one summer for Florida Rural Legal Aid doing migrant farm worker legal services. And I thought, I could do that and then do their oral histories and write the history of migrant farm work and the law. And turns out that's not really a career path. And I hope someone after me can make it a career path. But, you know, I was just trying to figure out how to combine the life of the mind that I really loved with making change in the world. And after I was in law school and learned that one could be a law professor where you were still part of the academic mission, but you also were teaching students who were going to be lawyers and you could be an expert and you could write amicus briefs. So it really combined those two things. That then became the path that made the most sense for me. And it has been a great path for me.
I would love that to be a career. I could see it, someone being a person who provides legal services, direct legal services, but also does oral histories or writes nonfiction work about their legal work. I think that would be great.
It didn't turn out to be my career, but I think it would be great for someone else's. Yeah.
Well, you did one half of it because a lot of your work focuses on the history of civil rights and what have you. But let me ask you this. Did you ever think about practicing law, or have you ever wished you had? Because I believe you spent your whole career in academia other than your clerking.
I have often thought about it. I feel like the legal path not taken for me was a public defender. And that's something that I think I really would have loved and would have been incredibly meaningful.
So you're a dean, you're a scholar, you're a fellow podcaster, you're a parent. Any tips for time management?
You know, there are so many tips. So Rich and I co-teach a class actually at the law school on work-life balance.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Not exactly the same as time management, but obviously related. We have done it for almost every year for 22 years. The first time we did it, we were about to have our first child and now she's, you know, well into college. So, you know, these are questions I've thought about a lot. And, you know, I think one piece is you got to have help. And I do think you can have it all, but you can't necessarily do it all every day. And you know, you have to make choices, but you also have to have help.
Now let's turn to current events in a way. You are winding up a very successful tenure as Dean of UVA Law School. You accomplished a ton. You made more than 30 star faculty hires. You established some dozen or so new centers focused on different types of scholarship. You led the law school through various crises, including the fallout from the Unite the Right rally in which a woman was tragically killed, the COVID pandemic, obviously. You did record-breaking fundraising, which a lot of people state as a huge part of a job of a dean in 2024. I know deans like to poo-poo them, but congratulations on an all-time high U.S. News ranking. But here's my question. Looking back over your deanship, what accomplishment are you most proud of?
So first, let me say thank you for that lovely recital. It makes it sound really good, and I appreciate the compliments. I'm proud of all the things that you mentioned. I would say there are a few student-related pieces that don't come out in that kind of recitation that I'm really proud of. So one is that we've increasingly had, you know, the most academically accomplished students in terms of the numbers over my deanship at the same time as increasing diversity along lots and lots of dimensions. And I'm very proud of that. We've increased access to the law school in so many different ways, which I think is really important. And I want to mention one, which is we created this Roadmap Scholars Initiative. We're in the third year of that. It's for first generation and low income college students. And it's a 2-year program, all expenses paid plus stipends, where we bring them to Charlottesville for a summer after their sophomore year in college. Our faculty teach them the law. We teach them about the legal profession and about law school applications. We then send them back with mentors. We pay for LSAT prep. We help them with their applications. They come back the second summer. We help them finish their applications and we orient them toward internships and we put them into legal internships. Stipends both summers, you know, tons of support, really kind of not just creating a pipeline, but a roadmap, right? Giving them the kind of resources, not just financial, but personal and network and educational and all of that, that students with resources have. And the first year of the program has just started applying to law schools. We've admitted our first student. She's got a bunch of offers, so I hope she comes to UVA. But even if she doesn't, it's a success. The students are amazing and inspirational, and I'm just really excited to watch the program continue.
That's fantastic. And I'm really glad you mentioned it because a number of my listeners are actually either pre-law students or even a couple of very civic-minded high schoolers. So I hope they will keep the program in mind because it sounds wonderful.
The other thing I was going to say is I think it's really important to be a big tent in a place that has lots of people of different kinds in every different way, and that creates access. And then I also think once people get here, you have to have a welcoming, inclusive culture that's also challenging and stimulating intellectually. And there have been a lot of headwinds against that, as you mentioned, Unite the Right and COVID. And so the other thing I would say I'm proud of, that's very hard to quantify, though I would say the Princeton Review 8 years in a row, best student culture, you know, best student quality of life does that a little bit, but just we've really worked hard to maintain our student culture, enhance our student culture, ensure that everybody who comes here feels a part of this place and like it's theirs to make, and also theirs to meet people who are different from them and to be exposed to other views. And so that is always a goal, I think, but has been especially important given hybrid learning and all the other, you know, headwinds that we've faced there.
Yes, and I think you've succeeded at it magnificently. I came back from UVA recently, having spoken there, and I popped by your office and you kindly chatted with me for a bit.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it was great. And that's when I kind of thought, oh my gosh, I have to have Dean Golubov on the podcast. But, you know, I really just saw that from the students. They just kind of radiated this positivity and they're so happy to be there and with each other. It's just great. But that kind of segues into, or I guess technically I should say segs, that kind of segs into my next topic. So some of my major issues at Original Jurisdiction concern free speech and intellectual diversity. And you just talked about how diversity would include a lot of things, including viewpoint diversity. And I just wrote a story the other week contrasting what I thought was a very productive and respectful form of protest at UVA Law with one that was maybe less successful at Berkeley Law. So how did you pull this off in terms of not having a Berkeley or Stanford or Yale law style free speech controversy in a time of incredible political polarization?
Well, that's a very kind description. I appreciate that. I will say, you know, the world is a complicated, polarizing place. And so I don't take anything for granted, and anything could change tomorrow. But our students work really hard to engage with each other. And I think, without commenting on other schools, which is not my way, but I can talk about UVA, you know, I do think that we're a fairly unique institution in being a big tent and being a real community, right? Those are the two kind of driving facts of our culture. We're diverse in every way, including, as you say, viewpoint diversity and ideological and intellectual diversity. That's true for our faculty. It's true for our students, our staff, our alumni. And at the same time, we're a real community and we really prize collegiality and community. And I think if you have real differences of opinion without community, you can be balkanized and people don't talk to each other. But because we have both, and our students are in small sections together, playing softball together, in the libel show together, they really prize their relationships and they know each other as real people. It's easier to have the difficult conversations, right? And so I think partly they come here knowing that we're a big tent and that they're going to be exposed to different kinds of views. Partly once they get here, we've got lots of programming to enable them and give them skills to have those kinds of exchanges of views, as well as we're pretty clear about, you know, we're a public actor, we're a state actor, we're bound by the First Amendment, and we have very clear policies. We share them regularly. You know, Leslie Kendrick, my successor, has been the special advisor to the provost at the university on free speech and free inquiry as the title, and she's a free speech expert. She's done a lot of those trainings for our students. So we're very clear on the law and the policy. And, you know, our administrators prepare, we talk, we plan, we talk to the students and have really productive conversations, I think, about free speech rights versus free speech norms, and thinking about both your right to exercise your free speech, both by inviting folks and by protesting, and also what the limits are in terms of policy, but also how do you want to interact with other people in the community? And I think we're in a place in the world where lots of people want rights for themselves and norms for other people, but we don't talk about that. And I think a lot of the free speech challenges we see out in the world are a result of miscommunication about whether we're talking about rights and norms. And you can think about both, and we do think about both, but you want to bring that to the surface and help the students think about the ways in which they want to interact with each other and with exposure to new ideas. And they do that all the time. I mean, our faculty are so ideologically and intellectually and methodologically diverse, and our students have them all. And so I think often when we think about free speech issues, we're thinking about events. And in fact, in the classroom every day, they're exposed to new ideas all the time. And then we have hundreds of events going on, and 99% of them, there's no protest. And then every now and then there is. And I think our students work really hard to think about what are their goals and what's the best way to achieve those goals, and talk to each other and our administrators and our faculty about that. And I've been really proud of them. It could change. There are always more stressors and more polarization, so we don't take it for granted, but I think they work really hard at it.
That makes sense. And that's really great. And knock wood, we're nearing the end of your tenure. So hopefully there will be no meltdowns in your home stretch. And it's really exciting that I think Dean Kendrick is going to be your dean, because she is an expert on these issues. And I think she and I are going to be on an ABA panel in a couple of weeks or months looking at these issues. But let me ask you this about faculty, because I think they're a key piece of this. And I think one of the contributors to UVA success is you have an intellectually diverse faculty. When you have faculty members who are authority figures in some ways to the students putting forth different ideas, students might understand, well, that idea is not an illegitimate idea because so-and-so thinks it. So you engaged in this incredible amount of faculty hiring. I felt that in the pandemic, or in the years after the pandemic, every other friend of mine, I know a lot of law professors, was going to your faculty. What factors made this wild hiring spree possible?
Well, thank you. So I do think, just to respond to that earlier thing you said, I do think the faculty are incredibly important in setting the tone, in modeling free exchange of ideas with each other, as well as in the classroom, and as well as their participation in, you know, student events and things like that. So I will say, I think the most important piece is our culture and our vibrant intellectual community. I know that when I interviewed at UVA for law school, I couldn't get over, even in my very first AALS half-hour interview, people were rigorous. They asked really hard questions, but they did it with warmth and generosity of spirit and from lots of different points of view. I still remember who was in the room and the different kinds of questions they asked. And it has made me a better scholar and a better person to be a part of this intellectual community. And I think it's obvious, you know, we're famous for giving good workshops, right? Our faculty read papers. The goal of the workshop is to help make your paper the best paper it can be. And I think people feel that as soon as they arrive here. I think often about how our faculty workshops really do model this kind of exchange of ideas across difference. And we had one faculty workshop where one person mentioned Hayek and said that the speaker was really embracing Hayek. And then somebody else said, no, I think the speaker's embracing Marx. I mean, really huge, wide range of ideas. And so for my podcast, I have this podcast, Common Law, and our theme this season is the free exchange of ideas. And I'm having two faculty members mostly, but a few other people who come on and talk about a particular topic who may agree on some parts, but not on others. And my goal was really to bring what we do in our faculty workshop out into the world so that people can see we really are engaging in this free exchange of ideas across lots of lines of intellectual and ideological difference all the time. So I would say that's the biggest piece. People want to be a part of this intellectual community. I also think, more specifically, kind of during and after pandemic, we're a very fiscally well-managed law school, and we had the capacity to hire at a time that a lot of other schools didn't. And so I think that was an additional comparative advantage that we had over those particular years.
And that can't be underestimated, because at the end of the day, a lot of this does come down to fundraising. So listeners, donate to your alma maters. But that's really true. And I know that you had a capital campaign where you hit the goal a year or two early. And the endowment, I think, has almost doubled under your tenure. And, you know, that's important, because ultimately, say, financial aid for first generation professionals, like, you know, this stuff depends on money. So you can't ignore the money piece. This podcast is being sponsored by NextFirm. If you have wondered whether launching a law firm could be the next best step for your career, NextFirm has the experience and expertise to help. Contact NextFirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com today to learn more. And follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for updates on future original jurisdiction guests. We're nearing the end of a very successful deanship. Did you consider staying on for another term, or is there an institutional norm against that? Because in looking at the roster of past deans, it doesn't seem that you have a long-tenured dean in the recent past of UVA law.
That is exactly right. You do good research, David Latt. So the average has been 7 or 8 years. This is my 8th year. And I think part of that is, and this again goes to our culture, I think, we tend to develop leaders from within. We always do a national search, but we do often hire from within. And I think after 7 or 8 years, the next generation is really ready. And so you don't want to stymie that. And we've got lots of great deans at law schools around the country who are our faculty members, who I think came out of our culture. And that's really positive. And we're so proud of them. But we also want some to stay here and become our successors, like Leslie Kendrick, though I was not part of that dean search in any way. But I do think that we're aware that this is a perpetual institution. It's over 200 years old now, and we get it for some short period of time. And we want to make sure that thinking about succession, we're stepping aside when people are ready to take the reins going forward.
That's really important because on the one hand, you want to have a good transition and you want to support your successor. But on the other hand, you need to give them space to breathe and to push forward their own priorities and vision for the law school. So I think that's really important. A remarkable number of law school deans have gone on to become university presidents. There's even a book, Patricia Salkin's May It Please the Campus, that's basically about lawyers who have gone on to become leaders in higher education, including university presidents. Might service as a university president perhaps be in your future?
I am not thinking about that right now. What I'm thinking about is my sabbatical next year and talking about giving your successor room, our tradition. I think partly because we do often hire from within is for the outgoing dean to go away. And so I will be in New York next year in your neck of the woods. I'll be in residence at NYU, which I'm very excited about. And then I'm coming back to the faculty and really excited to teach and write. I've been in the classroom some. I've taught most years something at the law school, but obviously not as much as you do when you're not dean. And I love the teaching. I love the students. And I have some ideas for some projects that have kind of been sitting, waiting for me to come back to. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's great. That's really wonderful. And I hope you enjoy your well-earned sabbatical. So I did have a couple of questions for you about other institutions, but you very diplomatically said that you do not wish to opine on goings on at other institutions, which I totally get. I don't know if this counts as opining on other institutions, but what would you say is the biggest issue or challenge facing U.S. law schools today?
I think that there are maybe two main ones. So one, I think, is a continuation of our conversation about polarization and democracy more generally. And, you know, we're in the business of creating professionals and creating lawyers and people who are going to be leaders. And we're doing so in just incredibly challenging times. And I will say one thing so generally about other law schools that I've been thinking about is I think that the polarization issues are national and they're everywhere. And they obviously show up in law schools too. I do think that to some extent, people are under the impression that the challenging events that we see in the news are the tip of an iceberg. And then there are dozens more events just like those happening every day at law schools. And I actually think every time there's anything challenging, we're seeing it in the news. And in fact, what's going on every day is tons and tons of events and speakers and discussions that are going off without a hitch. And I think it's important to remember that. And I know that to be true at UVA, but my sense is that's true everywhere. So there's a way in which we are already really responding to the polarization questions and working on them. But I do think they will continue to be something that law schools have to manage. And then in a totally different vein, I think obviously AI is going to shape the legal market. It's going to shape practice. It's going to change the nature of legal training. It's going to change the nature potentially of research, right? So there are so many different ways in which technological change are going to challenge the legal profession and law schools, I think, in the next decade or so.
That's so true. So true. And I'm curious, does UVA have an explicit policy on AI, or does it fall under general existing policies about academic integrity and honesty? And I ask this not necessarily saying you should. I actually have mixed views on the issue. I wrote a Bloomberg Law column saying that it's not helpful when individual judges have standing orders about AI that practicing lawyers have to just constantly check. There should be something more macro if there's going to be something, because things like Rule 11 already cover some of these AI fails we've seen, like relying on ChatGPT for hallucinated cases. But does UVA have an AI policy?
We have an honor code that's part of the whole university about lying, cheating, and stealing that obviously covers plagiarism and would obviously cover use of AI. We have said that you should assume that you shouldn't use AI for assignments unless your professor says otherwise. And we do have faculty who are already incorporating AI into particular assignments. And we think that it's really important both to ensure academic integrity, which was the question you were asking, at the same time as educate our students about these tools so that they can use them productively as they go into practice. So we've had practicing lawyers come in and talk to our students and talk to our faculty about the way they're using AI already in their practice and what they anticipate trends to be, because we want to make sure our students have all of the skills that they need to succeed, which include traditional skills of reading and writing and analysis, as well as new skills of interacting with the technology in efficient and productive ways. So we're thinking about it on both tracks.
That's really important. And for example, I was talking to a friend whose elementary school kids are having a class or a course on prompting, because using these AI tools requires giving good prompts, just as getting the right Westlaw or Lexis or Bloomberg results requires asking the right questions in your searches. So prompting, that's going to be a skill these days.
I think that's 100% right. And then the other skill that's really important is being able to assess the quality of the response that you get. And if you don't have your own independent knowledge or your own ability to do legal research, or you have nothing to compare the answer to your prompt to, right? You have to have expertise and knowledge and awareness in order to use these, right? Where we've seen lawyers getting in trouble is both they're using them when they shouldn't be using them, but also using them and blindly handing something in that has incorrect information. And so you have to make sure that however the tools evolve, we're creating lawyers who, you know, have what they need in order to use them appropriately.
Exactly. And it's similar to what we had before in terms of the challenge of search engines producing results. And you need to have the intelligence and good judgment to figure out which results are credible and reliable. Contrary to what my six-year-old son Harlan told me the other day, what he told me was Google never lies. Now, he may be right in the sense that Google doesn't have the mens rea, I guess you could say, to lie. But what he meant to say was anything you look up on Google is true. And we had to explain to him a little bit about search results and disinformation and misinformation.
But I think that's totally right. And I think I started law school 1 year before you, even though you finished before me because of my joint degree. I don't imagine this changed between my year and your year. But before we were given the Westlaw and Lexis passwords, we had to do our first legal research and writing assignment with the books, and we weren't allowed to have the, right? And I see that as totally parallel to now, right? There are tools, we should use them. Obviously, they're going to be helpful, but we also have to bring to those tools knowledge that makes us good users of the tools. And that hasn't changed. Obviously, the nature of the tools, the power of the tools, right? How much they're going to transform what we do, that is new, but it's a continuation of this technological transformation that we've been in for a while, I think.
You're dating us, you know?
Sorry, David.
I talk to one else these days and I say, do you use hard copy books? And they basically laugh at me. And I say, have you ever heard of a service called Shepherds? And again, they're like, Shepherds? So
yeah, well, now we're dating ourselves together. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So turning to my speed round of four questions that I pose identically to all my guests. My first question is, what do you like the least about the law?
I think that what I like the least is when the law loses sight of the people. And that doesn't always happen, but it does kind of happen as you go up, you know, the appellate process. It doesn't have to, but it often does, that as you get to more and more abstract legal questions, you can lose the humanity of the people involved and not take as much account of the effects and the consequences of legal decisions on real people. So that's something, you know, I'm a legal historian and I write about how do legal claims come about and how do real people come to think that the problems they face in their lives are legal problems, and then what happens once they do. And often what happens once they do is the cases take a life of their own and the people get left behind. And so I try to think we should always be attentive to the humanity and the effects on real people.
That's so true. And if I can plug a prior podcast episode when I interviewed Isha Anand of the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic, and I asked her about matters that she's proud of. She talked about one situation where she felt the courts did the right thing, but it had an unhappy ending, and another where she felt the courts did the wrong thing, but it had a happy ending. So I would urge all the lawyers and future lawyers out there to not lose track of their clients, who are the people in these cases. So my second question is, what would you be if you were not a law professor or dean?
I would be either a race car driver or a traffic engineer. I really enjoy driving fast, and I do so safely, only when appropriate. And I think all the time about traffic patterns and how traffic patterns work. So yeah, something along those lines.
That is really interesting. And I know you have some sabbatical projects lined up already, but it would be fun to write a law review article, maybe for a green bag type publication, about traffic laws. Because everybody's always writing about the 14th Amendment and all of these grand things. But when people hear you're a lawyer, they often ask you some question about the speed limit or jaywalking or something like that. So
yes.
I urge my law professor listeners out there, can someone write a really good article about traffic laws?
All right. I'm taking it under advisement.
My third question is, how much sleep do you get each night?
Oh, 6 to 7 hours, probably. I have a new Fitbit, so it really does tell me. And it's really usually somewhere between 6 and 7.
Okay, that's good. That's good. It's funny. I just got a new Fitbit 2 warning. They're not exactly as waterproof as you might think. So I think getting good sleep is important. And 6 to 7 is good. It's solid.
Yeah, it's good. That's a hard lesson to learn. The no Fitbit in the shower lesson.
Yes. And my closing question is, do you have any final words of wisdom, such as career advice or life advice for my listeners?
Oh, such a good question. So can I say two? I'm going to say two. Okay. So one is, you know, careers are long, right? Thinking about your listeners as law students or potential law students, right? Careers are long and varied. And I think this is true even for you high school students out there. People feel this way about college. Like, no one decision you make is determining the rest of your life. And go into some legal practice and you can go into other legal practice. And in fact, most people do. And so you shouldn't think that you're committing to something forever. And you shouldn't think you have to know exactly what you want to do before you go to law school, because most people don't. The other piece of advice is kind of a meta piece of advice. It's an interpretive rule, a canon of statutory interpretation for advice, which is know thyself. So the first time I was doing our orientation address when I became dean, I kept thinking of advice to give the 1Ls. And for every piece of advice, I thought, no, there's someone out there who needs the opposite piece, right? So there are folks who you want to say, take time off, don't forget to have fun. And other folks you say, don't forget to do your reading, right? And so I just think it's really important when people give you advice to think, is that advice for me? Am I the person that they have in mind when they're giving that advice? And I actually think any piece of advice you get for the rest of your life, if you ask that question about it, will be more useful to you in your own application.
That is great meta advice. And it's a variant of what I tell people when people ask me about parenting. They say, what's the best parenting tip? Because people have so many opinions. You think they have opinions about con law. They have opinions about parenting and this is the best stroller or this is how you sleep train your kid. And someone asks me, what's your best parenting tip? And mine is, do what works for you.
Yes.
If somebody gives me a parenting tip, I'll try it, but it may work for me or for my kid. My two kids are very different. It may not. So that is very wise meta advice. And nobody on the podcast in 40 plus interviews has actually, I think, said that.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, I'll tell you a funny one on the kid thing. When we had our first child and I was looking at all the reviews for strollers, there was one stroller they kept saying, this is the best stroller because the handles are adjustable and it works so great, on and on and on. So I get that stroller and I'm very short. I'm under 5 feet. And I'm walking with the stroller and my hands are falling asleep. And I go back and I relook at all those things. And they're all from tall people talking about how great that stroller is because they adjust upward. And in fact, the stroller was way too tall for me and I couldn't adjust it low enough and my hands fell asleep. So there are hard ways. It wasn't such a hard way, but I did learn, you know, that wasn't advice for me, right? Those folks had totally different concerns in mind and I had to figure out what worked for me. So I agree with you completely, David.
I love that anecdote and I have loved this interview. Thank you so much, Dean Golubov. I really appreciate all of your time and insight and your joining me today.
Thanks so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Dean Golubov for joining me. And congratulations to her on such a successful tenure as Dean of UVA Law. Put me down as predicting that she could be a university president someday. Thanks to NextFirm for sponsoring the Original Jurisdiction podcast. NextFirm has helped many attorneys to leave big law and launch firms of their own. To explore this opportunity, please contact NextFirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com to learn more. Thanks to Tommy Herron, my sound engineer here at Original Jurisdiction. And thanks to you, my listeners and readers. To connect with me, please email me at davidlatt@substack.com or find me on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at David Latt, and on Instagram and Threads at David Benjamin Latt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the Original Jurisdiction newsletter if you don't already, over at davidlatt.substack.com. This podcast is free, but it's made possible by paid subscriptions to the newsletter. The next episode should appear 2 weeks from now, on or about Wednesday, May 1. Until then, may your thinking be original and your jurisdiction free of defects.